You know, life can get rough sometimes. And even the most normal times have countless bits of dukkha or dissatisfaction in them. So we need to have a way to take a break. A break from our psychic suffering, some place to turn for relief and support. When the Buddha accepted new followers, he had them vow to follow the ethical guidelines and to take the three refuges before he taught them the Four Noble Truths or the rest of the Dharma. Now, these three refuges are not physical places, but realizations, conceptual frameworks that shelter us from dukkha and allow us to continue as we go along the Eightfold Path. And they are the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. Like any structure, whether it's physical or conceptual, the refuges need to be maintained to remain of service to us. So that's what I want to talk about tonight. What's involved in maintaining the refuges? And the first one is Buddha. The Buddha is an actual historic figure, a teacher, the enlightened one, an example for us to follow, and proof that we can be free from dukkha and achieve the ultimate happiness of Nibbana. Now, like all of the refuges, this one loses its use to us if we neglect it. We can maintain it by following Siddhartha Gautama's example and take to heart his insights into how we should live as set forth in the Eightfold Path in many, many pages of teachings that are part of what's called the Pali Canon. And in the Mahayana or the Tibetan traditions, many, many more pages. With all of the teachings that are available in the different traditions of Buddhism, they weren't taught for us to idolize the Buddha, but to have us achieve what he did. And in this regard, he inspires us, in the true sense of the word, inspire, to realize that same freedom from the countless dissatisfactions of normal human life. So a big part of maintaining this refuge is to touch into our own capacity to be enlightened. On a retreat, Jack Kornfield challenged me by asking me once to come back to our next interview and tell him what I understood it meant to be enlightened. What did it feel like, he wanted to know. So I spent the next 4 or 5 days exploring this in my practice, and I followed several different approaches. One was to just sit there gazing up at the sky and Another was to just fantasize about what it would be like to be in a state of continuous happiness. And I also reviewed what I had read and heard about liberation. And I spent many hours concentrating with metta and exploring the jhanas. None of these approaches led to the sense I ultimately got of nibbana. But altogether, from the peace and bliss of concentration to the joy of loving kindness and the confidence of living with the ethical principle of non-harming, my contemplations gave me a sense of what enlightenment is. And as Shakespeare said, here's the rub. This sense fades if it's not regularly refreshed. That's been my experience. And that's why I continue to revisit the elements of my own capacity to be a Buddha in my practice, my regular practice. Now, how I do that depends on what happens to be swirling around in my psyche at the time. If I'm under a lot of stress, I just try to remember that equanimity is possible. I've had it before, and I can have it again. A deep breath can be a moment of samadhi, the peace of concentration. Turning my thoughts to the well-being of others gives rise to the feeling of loving kindness, and it's a joyful feeling. Regaining mindfulness, just being aware of what's going on rather than being lost in it. Just that difference, an awareness that this is going on. That reminds me that there is the seed of Buddhahood in my nature. Now you might think that on an ordinary, tranquil day, it's the perfect time to cultivate all of these capacities. And it would be, except that those days are rare for most of us. And I personally seldom take any particular advantage of them. That's why it's so important to have a daily meditation practice that is done on the good, the bad, and the indifferent days. And retreats are especially good for connecting with our Buddha nature by developing samadhi and all the other benefits of mindfulness practice. Because, well, there you are. And what else are you going to do? There's a way in which it is a little misleading to talk about the Buddha and the teaching separately, because we see the Buddha through the teachings to such a degree that we tend to think they're one and the same. So before we leave this first refuge and go on to the Dharma, let me emphasize that the Buddha was a person, a live human being with thoughts and moods and swirling emotions, just like you. He sought for a long time, with a lot of effort, for relief from the dissatisfactions that he felt and that he saw other people feeling, regardless of the circumstances. In other words, he saw that suffering, or dukkha, was to a large degree independent of what was going on. We can suffer on a good day, sometimes just as much as on a bad one. And Buddha found this freedom, and then he shared it with the rest of the world. Gil Fronsdale, in his recent book, The Buddha Before Buddhism, noted that the earliest teachings emphasized that liberation is entirely possible in our daily lives as a matter of degree. These early teachings put no emphasis on the kind of cosmic explosion into some altered awareness that most people connect with the term enlightenment. It was just a part of daily life in the very early teaching. So really, you can stop thinking that you'll never achieve liberation. You do it every day. Gill says that in these early teachings, and I quote, "The personal qualities of someone who has attained the goal are the same quality one is to cultivate when training for the goal." In other words, one trains by being what one is to become. So just do it, to quote Tennis Shoes. So encourage yourself to seek freedom from inner distress as an ultimate goal and in your daily life, at good, bad, and indifferent times, and touch into the mindfulness, the serenity, and the loving kindness that's there right now. Be a Buddha daily. The Buddha is your refuge, so maintain it well. And the second refuge, the teachings, is not a treatise on how things are. It's almost the opposite. Most of the Dharma is manuals for how to see things as they are, for ourselves, to experience the truth of the moment in all of its impermanence. And as such, the Dharma is like the directions for getting to Carnegie Hall. Practice, practice, practice. Even the suttas that are the chewiest, that seem impenetrable the first time you read them, can flash into brilliant clarity when, instead of just being read, they're used as guidance for practice. The Dharma is intended to be used. It's a set of instructions, like what parents teach their children, lovingly meant to let us live happy lives that benefit those around us. And the key practice is letting go. This movement of the psyche, letting go, takes many forms. It can occur in the microsecond it takes to notice that we're lost in thought while we're meditating, and then willingly return our attention to the breath moment, we've let go of some seductive train of thought and come back to the truth here and now. Letting go can also play out over years as we gradually wean ourselves from deep and often destructive habits. As we practice letting go, we can be amazed to discover the almost infinite list of things that we cling to. The Book of Eights, that is the basis of Gil Fronsdale's book, and can probably be directly attributed to the Buddha as the author, includes these stanzas of a poem. Abandoning one thing, people cling to another. Pursuing craving, they don't transcend their craving. They let go, they grab. Like a monkey, they release one branch to grasp another. So whenever you contemplate the Dharma as a refuge, think in terms of verbs. What is this teaching suggesting that I do? Even the difficult teaching of anatta, or not self, gets a lot simpler when we think of it in terms of letting go. Just let go of the notion that you really are what you've come to think of yourself at. Just give it a shot. So here's part of another poem from the Book of Eights. Seeing benefit in the self, or in things seen, heard, and thought, or in precepts and religious practices, and grasping at this, a person then sees all else as inferior. What one relies on in order to see all else as inferior is an entanglement, say those who are skilled. And in this sense, entanglement is another word for clinging, which is the root cause of suffering. Now, it's entirely appropriate to respect and even revere the Dharma. It serves us as a GPS through life, given to us freely by someone who followed this path 2,500 years ago. And it was given to us in order to provide us with these directions through life. But rather than get attached to the directions as sacred, just use them for our own happiness. If we're following one of the folds of the path and it's not working for us, we can try something else, some other fold of the path or some combination of instructions. Now, I'll admit that I did a double take when I read that last poem about seeing the benefits of the precepts and getting attached to that, because I've been practicing a lot with the precepts for many years now. And then I understood that this poem is talking about grasping at them, holding my precepts as superior to the ethical guidelines that other people follow, which is completely irrelevant to my spiritual growth. What other people are doing has to do with their spiritual condition. In his teachings throughout the Pali Canon, Buddha warns repeatedly about the danger of clinging to views. The Dharma is not one of these views, or what we think of as an absolute truth. It's entirely relative. It's a set of instructions that work, if you work with them, for yourself. And the final of the three refuges is Sangha, very near and dear to my heart. There are several writers that I've encountered who talk about how all of the refuges, when they're understood deeply, are essentially the same thing. And actually, I could say that about all of Buddhism. It kind of all comes down to the same kernel of being aware of what's happening right now without clinging to anything. It's pretty simple, and yet it takes a lot of different perspectives on it to get a good overview. So when we are psychically in any refuge, it could be said that we're in all of them. And in another important sense, all the three refuges are manifest in our world in ways that have important distinctions. The Sangha, for example, is people. It's a collection of all of the sages over the millennia who, out of great generosity, have preserved and transmitted the Buddha's teachings. Sangha is real flesh and blood thinking and feeling people, many of whom you know personally. I've often told about an exchange between Buddha and Ananda, who is his cousin and attendant, in which Ananda asked, "Isn't it true, Lord, that spiritual friends are most of the Dharma?" That was a nice observation, to which Buddha replied something like, "Don't say that, Ananda. How can you say that? Spiritual friends are all of the Dharma." There are times when our practice brings us to places that are difficult. Sometimes it's simply because our cognitive grid, our way of seeing the world, has shifted, and it all looks unfamiliar and strange. This often happens when we begin to see through the delusion of self. Or we can get to a point in our spiritual growth where we've begun to let go of clinging in general. And it feels like the earth has fallen away beneath us. This is called groundlessness. And it is, in fact, the way things really are. But we haven't felt it before because clinging has given us the delusion of being grounded, sort of like fake gravity. These are times when we really need our spiritual friends. And that's why it's good to cultivate these relationships when we can, because these transitions often come up suddenly. In most of the interviews or practice reviews I do, people are facing the difficulties of everyday life, seeking to use what Buddha taught to let go where it's appropriate. conversations like this can be wonderful ways to establish this aspect of Sangha with one or more spiritual friends. It can be teachers, a Dharma buddy, someone you've gotten to know here in the Sangha, and just have a chat with about your practice. Underlying all aspects of the Eightfold Path is the importance of relationship. It's the guiding star of Buddhist ethics, the basic principle of non-harming. It is generosity and kindness. I'm so proud of this Sangha, the way you all welcome and support each other, and the many ways that you volunteer to help to keep this Sangha going. These activities are important ways to take refuge in Sangha and to maintain it. If you haven't personally participated in maintaining your Sangha, then I urge you to begin. It might take a while to find a way that suits you, but even if first tries don't work, keep trying. The rewards keep growing. In this refuge lies the essence of the spiritual life. So keep the refuges well maintained, and they will always be there to shelter and support you. Thank you.